Hello, this is Sean Seymour, one of the London Walkers, and this afternoon I'm going to take you on a little ramble around the areas of London known as the Inns of Court, and these are the areas for barristers. It's quite a very attractive part of central London. It's also very green, loads of green spaces and fantastic gardens. So the Inns of Court are Lincoln's Inn, Gray's Inn, Inner Temple, Middle Temple. Now, why on earth are they called inns, I hear you cry in mystified and puzzled tones. Well, let's go back for a moment to the 11th century. You're a knight, you're riding around, you fancy a drink, you stop at the alehouse to get your beer, you go to the tavern for your wine and your food, then you're tired, you want to spend somewhere overnight, you stay off at the wayside inn. So these were inns of hospitality for law students in the Middle Ages. Their actual official title are the Unincorporated Voluntary Societies for Barristers' Law for the Courts of England and Wales. Now, the barrister, if you're not familiar with these, is the advocate who wears the wig and the gown in the higher courts. There's about 16,500 barristers for England and Wales, and about just over 100,000 solicitors. Solicitor or general practitioners with wills and contracts, and if you're arrested, they're your first counsel generally. If you go to the higher courts, then the barristers plead for you and the financial meter really starts to move. Now, we're going to wander around this area. If we're extremely lucky, you might see one of these barristers in full plumage as we walk around. If I spot one, I shall say wig alert and point. There's also a huge architectural variety to look at this afternoon, and we're standing at the corner of Lincoln's Inn Fields and magnificent houses around us. Number 66 on the corner of their Newcastle House was the home for the Dukes of Newcastle in the 17th century, and it has been home for solicitors to the Queen, Ferrers and Ferrers, for many, many years. So every time a royal scandal erupts, there's some bit of activity. I haven't seen Prince Andrew recently, but never mind. Now, I'm going to take you down to the oldest house in the square, and we got down to some railings with some rather curious iron baskets outside, and they are oil lamp brackets. So in that basket was a glass holding oil, and they'd light it at sunset, put it out at sunrise. And you can see rather grand house, possibly designed by Inigo Jones, very important architect. And it was one house, later split up into two. You've got two front doors here. And on the right-hand side, you have a brown tablet commemorating Spencer Percival. Now, Spencer Percival was a barrister who prosecuted Thomas Paine, the English liberal who wrote The Rights of Man and Common Sense. He also prosecuted Colonel Despard, a colonel who was trying to plot to bring down the government and the king. The judge at the end, when he summed up, said, "Colonel Despard, you have endeavoured to import into this country a quite impracticable scheme of equality." So no chance whatsoever, of course, he was executed. Now, Spencer became Member of Parliament for Northampton, Chancellor of the Exchequer and Prime Minister. He's the only Prime Minister so far to have been assassinated. A man called Bellingham was made bankrupt by the government's foreign policies, and he shot him in a corridor of the House of Commons in 1812. Now, just the left-hand side of this house here, a garden court it's called, you can see another grey house, dates from the 18th century, and that was the home of John Forster, a solicitor, lawyer, and personal friend of Charles Dickens, and Dickens gave public readings of his books in the front room of the house. That's how Charlie earned his money towards the end of his life, not by publishing, but by doing one-man shows in theatres. His favourite trick was doing The Death of Nancy from Oliver Twist. He walked on stage and played everybody. Oliver, Bill Sykes, Nancy, the dog, the works. And he said, "Last night, I performed The Death of Nancy. I perfectly petrified some 2,000 people. 30 ladies were taken out of the theatre, fainted stiff with fright." And he uses this in his story Bleak House. Now, Dickens worked around here, knew exactly how the legal system worked, and this is a house of a man called Tulkinghorn, who was solicitor to Lord and Lady Dedlock in the story of Bleak House. It's the story of a contested will, Jarndyce versus Jarndyce. Well, the will's contested by the end of the story. No one against the family, it's all been trousered by the lawyers. And Dickens knew how this worked, he knew how the legal system worked. One quote from Bleak House is, "Some argue the English legal system has no principles. It has a major principle that of making money for itself." Anyway, let's go into the field now. And the field itself was originally a place for cows and sheep and was used by a group called the Knights Templar, the fighting monks, whose church we see later on this. And it was used for all sorts of things, for jousting, a place called Cup and Purse Field, where knights would fight, public executions in the 16th century, duels were fought here in the 18th, and now people come to play tennis and eat sandwiches, so things have moved on a bit. Now, we're going to head towards the first of our inns. It's not Lincoln's, just over there, but it's Gray's Inn, so we have a walk of about 4 or 5 minutes or so. We've now come to Gray's Inn. You can see a magnificent garden in front here. This is called the Walks, and you've got these amazing London plane trees either side, and in the distance, can you see, there's a tree that sort of looks like it's been blown over, surrounded by daffodils at the moment, and that's an American catalpa tree, or Indian bean tree, and the seed was planted by Sir Francis Bacon here in the 17th century, and we'll see his statue a bit later on. And notice the gates in front here. Wrought iron gates, rather splendid. They were installed, you can see the date, 1723. And you have T on the top. That stands for treasurer. So every time they do something new, like putting in gates or repair a building or whatever, the treasurer's emblems are displayed. The treasurer acts like a president of the society for a year. And the treasurer in 1723 was William Ian Gilbert, so his initials, which was displayed, spelt W-I-G, Whig. Very good for a lawyer, really, yeah. Now, the gardens are available to the general public at lunchtime only. Otherwise, less mortals such as we are not allowed to walk here. It's for people who work here and some who live here. Quite a few senior legal figures live in apartments at the top of the blocks at an extremely reasonable rate. I mentioned Charles Dickens earlier. In fact, Charles Dickens was a messenger and clerk here. In fact, it's incredibly boring. He would sit in the general office and in summer a cherry tree spread its branches across the office. He'd pluck the cherries, eat the cherry flesh, roll the stones around as ammunition, and take a legal document like a will or a contract and roll it up like a bazooka tube and fire cherry stones at people's top hats. He got his revenge from these bored afternoons by satirising lawyers in all his books. In actual fact, if you look at the end of the garden, where the traffic is, if you go in a straight line, you come to Doughty Street, and that was his family home, number 48 Doughty Street, where he wrote Oliver Twist. Fascinating museum. Another writer to come from here is one of my favourites. It's the poet Hilaire Belloc. He was a barrister who wrote rather strange cautionary poems for children. One of my favourites is the story of the boy who ate bits of string. The chief defect of Henry King was chewing little bits of string. At last he swallowed some which tied itself in ugly knots inside. Physicians of the utmost fame were called around, but when they came they answered as they took their fees, "There is no cure for this disease. Henry will very soon be dead." His parents gathered round his bed, lamenting his untimely death, when Henry, with his latest breath, said, "Oh, my friends, be warned by me that breakfast, dinner, lunch and tea are all the human frame requires. With that, the wretched child expires." Hilaire Belloc said, "When I am gone, I hope it may be said, his sins were scarlet, but his books were red." Let's find another literary figure as we go to the main South Square. It's a rather nice cars parked here, quite a few Bentleys and a couple of Porsches. It sort of indicates exactly what sort of money the barristers can make. But just over there is the statue of Sir Francis Bacon, an extraordinary character. He was a great moral and political philosopher, and some say the founder of empirical science. He said, "Knowledge itself is power." And he was Attorney General, Solicitor General, then Lord Chancellor. And got on quite well with James I. They were both gay and hypochondriac, and they'd swipe prescriptions together at dinner. He had to leave office as Lord Chancellor. He was found guilty of receiving bribes from both sides in the same case, and said he was being even-handed. They got him on a technicality. Poor old Francis. And some people said, or some still say, he wrote Shakespeare's plays. Dreadful anti-Shakespeare rumour started by a lady from America called Delia Bacon in the 1850s. She said, "How could this William Shakespeare write these plays? He was a grammar school boy from Stratford. Surely it was Sir Francis Bacon, great academic, Lord Chancellor, and as it happens, my relative." So on it said, "I'm going to sort this out. Dig up Bacon, dig up Shakespeare, get the coffin side by side, and get a boring old actor to stand in front and recite 'To be or not to be.' So the one who turns in his coffin is the author." Nobody tried that experiment, but his experiment was his last, Francis Bacon. He wanted to see how a chicken's flesh would survive deep freezing. This is a 17th century experiment. He bought this chicken from a farmer's wife in midwinter and gutted it and put ice blocks in the chicken's body and packed the whole thing around with snow, and rode home with his snowball chicken. The chicken was perfectly frozen, but he caught pneumonia and died. Very unfortunate. We do have a Shakespearean connection here because Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors was first performed here in 1594. In fact, Henry Wriothesley, Earl of Southampton, was Shakespeare's patron, the man to whom, we believe, he wrote half the sonnets. So you can see a griffin above the door here and one on top of the weather vane. And a griffin is a strange Harry Potter-like creature, half lion, half eagle, that's said to guard secret treasure, one of the emblems of one of the treasurers here. So we'll see lots of different symbols as we go around as well. It's quite fun pointing them out. Okay, one character I can't forget, and he was Lord Chancellor, associate of Winston Churchill. It was called Frederick Edwin Smith, otherwise known as F.E. Smith. Brilliant brain. During one particular case, the judge looked up from his notes and said, Mr. Smith, I have heard your argument, but I must confess that I'm no wiser than when you started. And Smith said, perhaps not, my lord, but much better informed. Another case, he was defending somebody who was allegedly drunk. You'll find my client was not drunk. You'll find Mr. Robertson was drunk. He was as drunk as a judge. Mr. Smith, I think you'll find the expression is as sober as a judge and as drunk as a lord. He said, well, as your lordship pleases. Always got it back. The best one, though, to himself and a judge, he was defending a tramway company accused of running over a young boy. And the boy came in on a stick, stuff hobbling away, and the judge said, quite incorrectly, oh, this boy's been injured. Somebody bring him a chair. I was pissed up to the company and said, well, perhaps your honour would like him passed around the jury box for inspection first. He said, what? That was a most improper suggestion. So it was provoked by a most improper remark on your side, my lud. Hideous silence in court. And the judge looked at Smith and went, yes, yes. Have you not heard the Bacon, the great Francis Bacon, once say that youth and discretion are ill-wed companions? Smith replied, yes. Have you heard the Bacon, the great Francis Bacon, also say that a much-talking judge is like an ill-tuned cymbal? What? You're very offensive. Yes, we both are. The difference between us is that I'm trying to be and you can't help it. Don't think you've won the case on that one. Now we're going to make our way out of this inn. We're coming out of the inn. We're going to go across the street and enter an inn of chancery. We've just come through the front of a 16th century building, one of the few to survive the Great Fire, and this is called Staple Inn. Now, Staple Inn was one of the inns of Chancery. There are many of these, Staple Inn, Thavies Inn, Furnival's Inn, Barnard's Inn. They don't have a function anymore. They acted as preparatory schools for young boys coming here and starting to learn law, and they completed their education in the inns of court. And their function was taken away in the 18th century. These are no longer lawyers' offices. These are offices for patent or patent agents. Patent office was quite close by. And we've come through into the 18th century courtyard of Staple Inn. Now, the word staple, interesting word, it meant the length of wool on a sheep. And wool was the staple or the support of the English economy right up to the time of the Industrial Revolution. So even in the 15th century, people would come from Florence to buy English cloth. It really was the best in the world. And if you go to the House of Lords, there's a huge great cushion there called the woolsack, and you see the judges sitting on it. Now have a look at the door here. Just over in stone is a woolsack, so that's its emblem. So originally a wool warehouse, later on a lawyer's association, now it's patent or patent agents. Some rather interesting patents are registered here, including the combined umbrella and paddling boat of 1908, the triple-decker mousetrap of 1963, the anti-snore wristband alarm of 1931, the transparent hospital gown of 1977, and my favourite of all times, the coffin with breathing tubes and spring alarms for the mistakenly buried of 1887. So I'm collecting more of these patents. It's quite fun. OK, coming out. Now we go past the Staple Hall there, as it were, and then go into Lincoln's Inn. Now that's the oldest one, the Blue Chip, best for name drops. So we've now crossed Chancery Lane. We've come through a 16th century gatehouse, and in front of you is a 15th century dining hall. This is Lincoln's Inn, that allegedly goes back to about 1295, regards itself as the senior of the inns. It's in this hall, incidentally, that Queen Elizabeth I came for a dinner. It was rather a long dinner, and these were lawyers and judges. They drank quite a bit. At the end of it, the treasurer was supposed to stand up and propose the loyal toast of God save the Queen. He was completely plastered, couldn't stand up. The Queen said, never mind, dear, do it sitting down. So there are very few societies that can say God save the Queen sitting down. Lincoln's Inn is one of them. The Vintners Company, the importers of wines, because Charles II got drunk with them, and the Royal Navy, who were permanently drunk in any case. Now, on those old ships, you couldn't stand up. You just said, God save the King, sitting down. So, now, talking of royals, turn round, you can see the emblem, a crown, and the date 1967, and Margaret. This is Princess Margaret, the Queen's sister, and who died some time ago. And she was... Yes, quite a rackety royal, shall we say, and she was the honorary treasurer here. I don't believe she did a great deal of administrative work, just came here and drank a lot of gin and tonic, that was it. But it's very prestigious to have royals associated with the Inns. I mean, Prince Charles is for Gray's Inn and Prince Philip Inner Temple, the Queen for Middle Temple, interestingly, which we'll get to much later. But old boys from here include Sir Thomas More, the Chancellor who lost his head because Henry VIII wanted to get divorced from wife number one. William Penn, the radical Quaker who founded Pennsylvania. And we also have William Pitt the Younger, the youngest Prime Minister we've ever had. Extraordinary talent. At the age of 6, could translate any Latin or Greek text. At the age of 14, went to Cambridge University. 21, became barrister. And 24, Prime Minister. Not bad. He's the Prime Minister who introduced income tax as a temporary measure. So, well done, Mr. Pitt. Amazing brain, but an amazing drunk. He got through 1,800 bottles of claret in 1 year. There's one person drinking this. And he suffered from gout. So his doctor recommended he drink port to help the gout. They died fairly young, these people. Other chap to mention, Benjamin Disraeli. He was Queen Victoria's favourite prime minister. Although he was a Jew, his father had an argument with the local synagogue, had his son baptised as a Christian. I mean, Jews couldn't enter Parliament till 1858. Although, as an MP, he had to endure all sorts of anti-Semitic insults. And one person said to him, you know, what are you, Christian or a Jew? He said, consider me the blank page between the Old and New Testament. Pretty good reply. And there's another shout of Shylock from the chambers. And he said, Mr. Speaker, when the honourable gentleman's ancestors are running naked around these islands, mine were high priests in the Temple of Solomon. Never forgot his Jewish ancestry. I'm very proud of that as well. Another one, some rackety thing, you know, here comes Jew boy. Mr. Speaker said, half the members of this House are idiots. And the Speaker said, you can't say that, Mr. Disraeli. It's ungentlemanly. You must apologise. So, right, very, Mr. Speaker, I apologise. Half the members of this House are not idiots. Good one, yeah. Oh, and another character, of course, Margaret Thatcher. Can't forget her. And she was a research chemist, first of all. And then she became a barrister, specialised in taxation law. Highly appropriate. Then became Member of Parliament and finally Prime Minister. And the Iron Lady, as she was known by the Russians, has now passed on. Although one socialist said, the Iron Lady, may she rust in peace. Very divisive politician. Very strong, though. Very, very courageous in many respects. And her cabinet was once described as a tigress surrounded by hamsters. Rather nice image, isn't it? We're here underneath the chapel now, and it's called the Undercroft. And there's somebody buried here, you can see his name, John Thurlow. He was Secretary of State to Oliver Cromwell during the Cromwellian period, our brief republic. And when Cromwell died, his son Richard tried to take over the job and failed. They called him Tumbledown Dick. And Charles II was asked to come back, and Thurlow was put in the Tower of London because he was the opposition. But they released him a few months later. He knew too much and needed to keep him going. Anyway, he lies here. The chapel we're standing under, in the Undercroft sheltered area, was consecrated by John Donne. And John Donne, of course, became, you know, the great poet, and lines like Go and Catch a Falling Star. And now there's an interesting bell in the chapel called the Benchers Bell. And they're ringing out to indicate when a bencher has died. And people would hear this bell going bong, 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 and send out their clerks and servant to find out who was dead. They knew there was an election coming up. And John Donne must have observed this behaviour and gave us the immortal lines, therefore never send to ask for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. Now, we're just coming out. We're standing in a place. You see the name Old Square up there. It's not particularly old. It's only 1870s, but it's always been called Old Square. And they were doing a documentary programme about Tom Denning, who was Master of the Rolls, very important figure in the 1960s.
and he was squared up with a camera, and his head was just the left of where it says Old Square. The director looked at the viewfinder and said, "You better move, sir." "Why is that? Why have we got to move?" "Well, it's saying Old Square by your head." And he said, "Well, I am one. Carry on filming." Good sense of humour. Coming through here, we see a large green area. Yeah, it's called the Coney Garth. Coney Garth is Old English for rabbit garden, really. And there's an interesting excerpt from one of the regulations of the 14th century. It says, "If a student of law is found to have had or enjoyed a woman in the Coney Garth, he must pay a fine of 20 shillings. If he is found doing the same in his chambers, he must pay 100 shillings." These were aristocratic young men misbehaving and spending all their father's money. Dreadful lot. Now, I hope at least to show you one wig on this walk. We haven't seen one of a live barrister walking around. So come with me to a shop. It's called Eden Ravenscroft. You see the best wigs in the world.